Superpod 2020, raising money for sport relief. 2 days of great comedy and sporting podcasts. Desert Island Dicks. Sports Spiel. Life Goals with Theo Delaney. The Dredgeland Podcast Spectacular. And more. Saturday 7th and Sunday 8th of March at The Social in Southampton. And you can be there too. Free entry until 7 p.m. and then ticket only from 7 p.m. Tickets available now at superpod.co.uk. If you can't be in Southampton, the whole event will be streamed live online on your smart speaker and on Facebook Live. Find Superpod UK on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram and use the hashtag Superpod2020. For more information, visit superpod.co.uk.
Momentum is a big thing for Middlesex County Cricket Club batsman Stevie Eskenazi. The Mintridge Foundation ambassador won the county championship title back in 2016, and that word, momentum, was a massive factor, as he explains in his conversation with Will in this episode. It was momentum that played a crucial part in Middlesex claiming county cricket's greatest crown in 2016. But the same momentum also saw them relegated with little help from a crossbow arrow in one of the sport's most bizarre incidents just a year later. Will and Stevie also talk about how the heroics from England's World Cup winning men's cricket team and Ben Stokes' incredible innings in the Ashes could help lead an exponential growth in the popularity of the game in this country. They also discuss how the 100 could enhance the sport's popularity even further. Stevie also talks about how he became a professional cricketer virtually overnight, adapting to life in London when he literally knew nobody, and he also talks about how much he enjoys working with the Mintridge Foundation. He also explains how he feels it is so important that young cricketers are given the very best opportunities to forge a career that has given him so much.
Welcome back to the show, listeners. And as I promised before the break, we are here with Steve Eskenazi, professional cricketer for Middlesex County Cricket Club. How are you doing, Steve?
Yeah, I'm very good, thanks. Very good. It's been an awesome couple of days here with Mintridge, meeting all the other ambassadors and athletes from 25-30 different sports, and all completely different to mine, so it's been awesome.
We were actually just talking then off the record about, you know, the interactions you've had even just overnight and today with the different athletes, and how much do you enjoy sort of spending time hearing other people's stories and learning about how other people have excelled in their sport and then sharing your story as well?
Oh, it's massive. I was actually saying before, I spend a lot of time with professional athletes, but that's what happens when you're living and breathing and working with 25 professional cricketers. Come here and hear the stories of people from 20 different sports, people at different stages in their career, people who have retired, people who are breaking through. It's been amazing. I mean, I just had a conversation there with one of the ambassadors here who was a sailor, who was talking about a 9-month round the world race where there were 4 hours on, 4 hours off for 3 weeks at a time. And it honestly is just mind-blowing. I mean, to think there's some people in this room who race for 11, 12, 13 seconds, and some people who race for 9 months. You know, I play a completely different sport. It's been a real eye-opener, and I've loved chatting to people about preparation, chatting to people about, you know, different aspirations. It's been completely different, and to be honest, I've been gutted that this has been the first one of these that I can come to, because it's been awesome.
We were listening before the break, before we started recording, to some really inspirational stories of people, you know, telling how they've got through the sport, the challenges they've overcome as well. Is that something that you really sort of enjoy listening to and you've really taken something from?
Yeah, I think it's a massive cliche that people who get to the top of their sport suffer setbacks. But listening there, people didn't know they were going to have to speak about them. People got plucked at random, and every single person had some pretty harrowing stories about how low they've gotten in their sport. We're talking about people who have captained England in Commonwealth Games, people who have won gold medals at Paralympic Games. I mean, incredible achievements, but they've probably been lower than I could have imagined before that. So it kind of normalizes things a lot. And over the last 2 years, I've had some serious ups and downs myself. And, you know, these things creep into your head. And to come over here and have that reassurance of people who have fundamentally been, you know, astronomically successful, to have gone through similar and far worse, is really quite comforting as well. And it's a reinforcement of a lot of things. But when people say it to you, who haven't been through, I guess, what you've been through or worse, it's quite difficult. But there, to relate to people's experiences was, yeah, phenomenal.
And of course, they were telling these stories as part of the ambassador training you're doing. And how important do you therefore feel that other people get to hear these stories, children, aspiring athletes as well?
Massively. I mean, Alex has spoken about the reason why she started this company was because she immediately thought that an impact that someone, like any number of the people in this room, could have had on her, who could have known what that would have done to her and her career. So I think fundamentally we owe her a lot, because I've sat in training days and I've sat on school visits where I've listened to the other person, and I've got more out of that than any conversation I've had with anyone before. And I think if I was a 12, 13, 14 year old person who had aspirations in anything, I mean, for me it was sport, but to hear these stories and to hear how normal these people are, I think is incredible. And that's one thing that I try and get across when I'm speaking, and a lot of these guys do the same thing, is trying to get these kids to understand that we were in the exact same position that they're in. We go through and have been through the exact same emotions and ups and downs. And if England captains and Paralympic gold medalists and Olympic gold medalists can do that, there is fundamentally no reason why anyone in that room shouldn't have those aspirations as well.
How did you get involved with Mintridge in the first place? Did you approach them? Did they approach you? How did this all come about?
Yeah, it was an interesting one. Phil Weston is my manager, or my agent, who is friends with Alex and her family and has been involved with Mintridge for a little while. And he came to me about 2.5 years ago and said, look, there's an opportunity. Initially, it was for a back of the bat sponsor, which in cricket is just a small sticker you put on the back of your bat. And it helps promote a company, and often you get, you know, a small amount of money as a player. And he said to me, look, there's an opportunity here. It's not just a purely commercial thing. He said, I think it's going to be a really good personal development opportunity for you, and I think you're the style of person that Mintridge you're looking for. So I had a Skype with Alex where she just essentially explained the program and explained the charity and explained, I mean, they were in their infant stages at this point. Even in such a short space of time, they are mind-blowingly bigger now than they were back then, or than we were back then. And immediately it was something that I wanted to do. I love working with... We have an opportunity and reach as athletes that I think often is overlooked. At Middlesex, we do a lot of work with the Ruth Strauss Foundations and the Felix Project, helping in different ways with those charities. But the one I've really sunk my teeth into is Mintridge, and it just sort of, it epitomises everything that I want to make sure I give back to my sport and give back to people who were in similar situations to me. Because as we've all said, we've worked hard, but we're all extremely privileged. So it is definitely our duty to give back, and Mintridge provides an amazing platform for that.
And what sort of opportunities have you had during your time with Mintridge, and what has maybe been some of your sort of favourite experiences?
Yeah, I think initially, the first thing I did with Mintridge was I went into a school with Nakoda, who is a judo ambassador, and I listened to the first 10 minutes of her speech, and my jaw honestly hit the floor. Her story was so incredibly inspirational and emotional, and to be honest, mine didn't have a patch on hers. So initially when I heard that, I knew I was where I wanted to be. I was with like-minded athletes who had similar aspirations and goals. I knew they wanted to give back and help. And I just think it's been incredible for me, once I started working with the kids, to sort of firsthand see the impact they have. When someone's explaining something to you, it all sounds really quite good in theory, but anyone can pitch you anything. It was only when I started working with the kids, with Bailey and Jamie, who are my first two mentees, and then Riley and Harriet, who are my second two, and having two full cycles with them, 2 6-month cycles of mentorship, that I've genuinely seen an impact that the charity and I feel that I've made on them. You know, increases in confidence, how comfortable these guys are in asking some really tough questions for young people. And the amount of trust that they put in you as someone who they speak to once every 2 weeks on Skype has been unbelievable. So, as I said, at the start I thought it was a great idea, and only now, a couple of years in, with some really positive experiences, do I firsthand see the impact. And I think the scope for growing what we're doing here, what we're about and our message is huge, because I think if people haven't heard about it, it's just incredible. It's an incredible thing that I think needs to grow and grow and grow.
Is that something you think a lot more athletes are starting to recognise as well, that the fact you are such inspirational, powerful role models, and that you actually have a platform to help children who may be going through a difficult period or may need a confidence boost?
Yeah, I think that period of reflection is amazing as well, because we just heard five or six of the ambassadors, and pretty much every single person said, you know, there was one or two people who sparked their career. Like, almost as simple as that. It was one conversation or one meeting or something that took them from having an aspirations in one thing to being a sports person. So I think for us to have the privilege to be able to do that with young people is incredible. And, you know, these days with social media reach, and these days with the fact that we're lucky, I mean, sport is fundamentally seen as cool. I think that helps a lot. So people want to get involved. And I think in order for us to really engage with them, the onus and the responsibility is on us to drive it. Vintage is one thing, but I think even fundamentally doing more outside, and that's why chatting to different people about, you know, even the ways that we can help other sports and help get this message out there, I just think it should be a non-negotiable. There's definitely a sense of, maybe arrogance is not the right word, but I think when people aren't given the knowledge of how they can help, they don't really want to, and they think it's going to be more effort, or they think it might detract from their career. But understanding how it can help an extraordinary amount of other people, but also selfishly help you, because the satisfaction that you get, the personal growth that I've got through this process has been huge. And I've probably got as much out of a lot of the mentees. So really, it's kind of the gift that keeps on giving in that sense. Everybody benefits in it, and I think that's something that I keep reflecting on as well.
You spoke there at the start of your answer about how a lot of people in this room have had one or two people that have sort of sparked their career. I guess I could ask you sort of the same question. Was there one particular moment or person that really sparked your interest in cricket and has got you to where you are?
Yeah, it's a really funny one. Another common theme that we've all spoken about is how many sports we all played growing up. I mean, I was a big hockey player, tennis player, cricketer growing up. I lived in the west coast of Western Australia, so sport was a part of our culture massively, and being outdoors was. And I sort of, I guess, whittled that down to two sports, which was hockey and cricket, at about 15, 16, 17. And it was always something that I suppose you dream of, and I loosely wanted to do very seriously, but I wasn't entirely sure of the process. And I think that's one of the main things that the kids get out of our sessions, is understanding that process. It's not about being in an academy when you're 10 years old. There's people whose careers, people whose journeys started at 17, 18, 19. Which is amazing. I suppose from my point of view, I played good level club cricket and underage cricket for Western Australia, and played good level hockey up until I was about 18, and then fundamentally, lifestyle wise, everything about the quality of life of a cricketer compared to a hockey player was a decision that wasn't easy for me to make, but it was a no-brainer. If I wanted longevity in my career, if I wanted to focus and I wanted resources, it was unfortunately something that hockey couldn't have given me at the time. So I went to university and I did a year of a double economics degree in Perth whilst playing cricket semi-seriously. I thought I was going to get signed professionally by Western Australia, and it didn't quite happen there for me, which was a huge setback, because all I'd ever done was envisage playing at the WACA, playing for Western Australia. I have a British passport through my mum, and I lived in the UK for 8 years, and I was going to come over and play league cricket in Hampshire. Just club cricket, just get away, spend a bit of time focusing on myself, seeing what cricket could do. And then essentially overnight, I got a phone call from Angus Fraser and Richard Scott, who were the head coach and director of cricket at Middlesex, saying that Paul Terry, who was a mentor of mine growing up, had been in contact, and had sort of pitched the fact that I was looking to come over, that I had the ability to play as a local player, what I'd done in age group stuff in Western Australia and grade cricket. And they said, come over next month on a 2-year scholarship to be a sort of junior professional at Middlesex. And it all really kind of happened overnight. I was a university student who enjoyed playing league cricket on the Saturday, and I was in professional cricket on the Sunday. So it really was as fast as that.
You mentioned there that you'd grown up, you'd spent time growing up over here in England. I guess, did that sort of help them going from Australia, living in Australia, to coming over to England? For some, many, that could seem quite daunting, but I guess for you, was it therefore slightly easier that you had spent time in both?
It's an amazing thing. When I look back on the period of time where I moved here as a 19-year-old kid, I can't really quite believe what was going through my head. I always think back to getting on the tube, going to my first session at Lord's, having never been to the ground other than maybe a tour when I was 14, meeting this group of 20-odd people with test players and guys who had first-class averages of 50, and I can't imagine what I was thinking at the time. And I look back and I think, I'm quite proud of myself for the way I handled it, because moving over was, yeah, it was daunting, and it was, to be honest, it was awful at the start, because while I lived in England, all of my support network here were based down in the south of the country. I moved to northwest London and lived with a family of five in an area of north London that couldn't have been more different to where I grew up. It was about 2 degrees the day I landed, and I left and it was 38 degrees. And I just kept asking myself, what am I doing here? This is just, couldn't be less of what I'm looking for. But like all these things, if you give it time, it's amazing how it's grown. Now I can't think of being anywhere else. I think back, it would have been easy for me to have packed in and gone home. But also, one of the great things about it was that my hands were tied. There was no opportunities back in Perth. So if I wanted this as a career, I was going to have to go through some pretty dodgy times at the start. And I didn't really have a choice, which I think helped me. If I did have the choice to go back and maybe play professionally in Perth, who knows what would have happened. But now, it's my family. I've been there 8 years. I love the city. You know, I'm spending more and more time here. And I couldn't see myself being anywhere else at this point.
You mentioned there how different London was from home and how sort of difficult it was. Were there any sort of particularly tricky moments at the start, or was it just gradually getting used to life over here and how things were different?
Yeah, massively. Well, my dad came over initially for the first week, helped me settle in. I would say the cricket, because I came over at the start of the summer, and anyone who knows anything about county cricket knows that the schedule is just mad. You know, you're playing 5-6 days a week for 6 months. So it wasn't necessarily the feeling of isolation or being away from friends. It was the fact that for the first time ever, my emotions and, you know, I had a job for the first time, first of all, so I had responsibilities, and my emotions were fluctuating based on my performance for the first time. So I remember my first ever second 11 game for Middlesex. I was opening the batting, and I think I got a third ball duck, and I left one that in Australia and in the conditions over there would have bounced over the stumps, and I got absolutely cleaned up and laughed off the pitch. And I was like, okay, this is a lot different to where I've come from, and also this is affecting me. Where I was playing as a social cricketer before, albeit at a higher standard, it wouldn't necessarily define me or affect the way I was going to go about my daily business, whereas this now was something that was there for me and was something that was going to affect me. So yeah, it really was an interesting change for me, and I found everything about it was difficult, not being with my family and my mates. But now that I look back on what I have and the support network I have, I don't think I could have been any luckier, really.
It's been, you mentioned sort of how sort of Middlesex has become your family. You've actually been able to captain the team on a few occasions this year. I guess, how much of a special place is that county and that group of guys hold in your heart now?
Yeah, massively. As I said, I came over here and I didn't know a single person that lived in London, not one person. To think 8 years on, you know, there would be 10, 15 people that I would consider, except my family and my close mates. Some of the things we've gone through as a group of men in the last 2 or 3 years has been both unbelievably good fun and extremely painful. I think those experiences bring you extremely close with a set of guys. I mean, I had played 6 first-class games and was walking around Lord's holding the county championship, being told that this was as good as domestic cricket gets, and 2 years later we were relegated and finishing 16th out of 18. So I think having those shared experiences helps a group come together, and I think playing poorly like we have in the last 2 years, often people can say that's reflective of a fractured dressing room or people who aren't close, but funnily enough I think we're probably closer now as a group of people than we ever have been, because you certainly learn a lot more about yourself and a lot more about your teammates in the bad times. So yeah, I think I am extremely lucky. One thing I always say to people about coming to London was, if you come over here and you're looking for a job, that's tough work. I came in here and I was dropped in an environment of 20 guys. who were all extremely accommodating. You know, you weren't best friends with everyone that you played with, but you had at least 10 to 12 people who were similar to you straight away. So I didn't have to go out looking for people that were like-minded, looking for people who had similar aspirations. They were on my doorstep. So those relationships started really, really quickly, and they've built ever since. So yeah, they're my best mates now, they're my teammates, they're phenomenal people, phenomenal cricketers, and the club itself, we face challenges purely based on where we are. I mean, London's a great city for young professional cricketers, and Lords is obviously a great place to play, but we face challenges. No one really lives close to each other. It doesn't have that village family feel, because we can't all nip down to the local pub. Like if you played for Northamptonshire or Leicestershire or Derbyshire, you know, people could say coffee in 5 minutes. I live an hour and 45 minutes away from one of my mates, which is unheard of, but it's the nature of the beast living in a city like London. So when we have that time together, yeah, it's extremely special.
You've touched upon it already, and one of those special moments was winning the county championship in 2016. I guess, if you can, because I remember sort of watching the game, and it was a roller coaster of a season and a game. Sort of, what were your emotions when Toby Rowland-Jones took the hat trick and sealed the title on the, I think it was the final day of the season?
Yeah, final session of the season. Yeah, it was an amazing season, really, because I was out of the side halfway through the year. I'd played one first class game the year before. I was out of the side, and I actually remember before I made my, not my debut, but my first game of that particular season, I actually got 3 ducks in a week against Surrey in the second team. And in one day, on the Monday, I got a second ball duck, and in both innings of the 3-day game, I got 2 ducks. And I was like, what is going on here? I've gone completely backwards. The next week, I was picked in a 4-day game against Lancashire, got 100 in my second game, and the following week, got 100 against Yorkshire and Scarborough. Fast forward 6 weeks, we were a game away from winning the county championship. The game itself was an odd game because it ebbed and flowed, and there were certain elements of the game being set up. But fundamentally, we had the most wins. We'd played the best in the season. And I look back on it now, after 7 games, did I really fundamentally understand what I did or what we did for the county? Not at all. It was a pretty cool thing that I watched back and look back on photos and think I did it right. But I was so naive to what we were doing. And we hadn't won for 23 years, but I'd been the club 5. I had never had a bad game. I'd never lost a game. I was averaging 55. So everything about it was easy. It was a flow-on effect. And the guys here have spoken about it. We look back on periods in your career where things happen so easily and you don't think. Whereas now, after being relegated and struggling, I think if I was to experience that again or go through what we went through, I think my appreciation for it would be 100 times over. Because, you know, some people go, Marcus Tiscothic retired this year, never got to hold the county championship. So for me to do it 6 games in is an amazing thing to reflect back on and touch on and learn from. But yeah, I think it all happened kind of too quickly and too easily for me initially, and I blinked and all of a sudden we were in the hard work the next year. But it was amazing. It was an incredible thing. And to think about how hard the last few seasons have been to fight for 5th position in the second team and in the second division, and, you know, fight for promotion places, to think that we won it quite convincingly outside of Yorkshire and Somerset that year was an incredible achievement.
You mentioned there that you scored a ton against Yorkshire, and a lot of people say that game, the first time you met that season, was the game that actually almost defined the championship and the way it swung in your favour. When you had scored that ton, when you got the result, you got that game, did you therefore think at the time, this is coming, you know, effectively this is coming home, or did you not quite realise?
No, 100%. First of all, because Yorkshire were actually on top of the ladder at the time, and they'd been the best team in the country for 5 years. I think they'd won 3 county championships in a row, or they were going for their 3rd one. So they were the benchmark. So to play the way we did in a notoriously difficult ground to win, and in the fashion we did, was pretty phenomenal. I mean, I got runs in the first innings, but the game was petering out to a pretty placid draw on the 4th day, and it was Toby Rowland-Jones and Tim Mertz's batting actually that got us in a position to win the game. And winning the game on the last session there, it kind of flipped the season on its head, because not only did we beat the first side and go to top, it became like a run-in, a championship run-in, where we had 5 games left and we said, well, if we win 3 and don't lose the other 2, we're probably a good chance. Whereas before, you're still building up that kind of foundation of points to get in a position. Whereas there, we were like, okay, now it is very real. And now the difference between 1st and 5th is big. And all we need to do is probably play all right here to be a chance. So I think our mindset massively changed there. And sport's a massive game of momentum. I mean, every sport. It's huge for momentum, but cricket is something that I've been on the receiving end of in both ways. I mean, the momentum we had going into that last month of that season was amazing, and alternatively, the momentum we've had in struggling in the last 2 years has been incredibly hard to fight against as well. I mean, probably harder, I would say, to turn the corner when things aren't going for you, when a crossbow arrow hits the pitch and you're deducted 2 points for your over eight and you get relegated on the back of that. Takes the wind out of your sails, and it's incredibly hard to come back. So I think the biggest learning I took from that was momentum and how important it is, especially in cricket.
I'd forgotten about the crossbow incident. Can you sort of explain a little bit more about that?
Oh, it was madness. It was so funny. We were talking about archery before, and I was like, my relationship with arrows is actually shocking, because essentially what happened was day four of a four-day game against Surrey. We hadn't played amazingly all year. It was a year after, a bit of a championship winning hangover, whatever you guys want to call it. And about three games to go, the game was petering out to a draw. We were going to bat the last hour and a half, then we were going to bowl. We were two down on our over eight, which for any listeners who don't understand that, you have a certain amount of overs you have to bowl in an hour and in a session and in a day. And every time you go below that, you lose points. It rarely happens. There's certain parts of the game you might be below, but at the end of the game, everyone's usually level. And we were going to bat the day, and essentially what happened was we had an agreement with Surrey that we were going to declare. There was no way they were going to have any time to chase the amount of runs that we had ahead of them, but we were going to bowl for 20 minutes, regain our over eight, shake hands, and the game was going to be a draw. So what happened was I was actually out earlier in the day, and I was being a runner for Nick Compton and John Simpson at the time, and a crossbow bolt quite literally came out from the sky and landed about 2 metres from Rory Burns, who was fielding at cover. And we sort of looked, everyone sort of heard the like boom and hit the ground, and we looked around. We had no idea what was going on. The umpire sort of pulled this thing from the ground, and it was an arrow. And everyone was a bit confused there, and then everyone sort of realised how sharp and dangerous this thing was. So we all sprinted off. The anti-terrorism police came, because we didn't know if there were 100 of them going to come over, or I don't think anyone really got to the bottom of what happened. But fundamentally, the effect was we were two down on the over rate, which is theoretically supposed to be a loss of 2 points. But we had an agreement with the umpires where we said, due to the unforeseen circumstances of what's just happened and the fact that it was no one's fault, and due to the fact that we all know cricket and we all knew that we were going to get our overs back, can we please have them back? And it was fundamentally a clerical error where they didn't, in the match report, put down, we reserve the right to give Middlesex back their 2 points. We got 2 points taken away from us after that game, and we got relegated the week after playing Somerset on an interesting pitch by 2 points or 1 point. So I never like to sit here and give excuses. I mean, fundamentally, we didn't play well, but also fundamentally, we lost by the exact margin that was taken away from us on that day. So it was bizarre, but it's amazing how that something that small can really turn the momentum against us, and we've been fighting against that ever since.
I think I've just been given the hurry up by Alex, so I think we'll stop there, but if that's alright with you, we'll carry on later.
Absolutely,
if that's
right. Yeah, no, it's a round of it. Beautiful.
Make sure you follow Sportspiel on social media. Search for Sportspiel Pod on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or on LinkedIn.
So welcome back, listeners. We've changed venue for the second part of our special with Steve Eskenazi. We talked about momentum and the end of the first part, and I guess cricket has had somewhat of a momentum boost this summer in this country in particular, with the World Cup victory and the Ashes, although the England didn't win the Ashes. What Ben Stokes did in that third test was incredible. What's it been like being a cricketer in England in 2019 with all that happening around you?
Yeah, it's funny, we joked before, we were doing an exercise on public speaking, and we were joking before about how cricket before this year wasn't cool, and all of a sudden we've become rock stars, really, because it's amazing how many people have engaged with the sport of all ages. The ECB are introducing this new competition, and they're talking about trying to engage new audiences, and I think the sport itself has done that over the past 18 months. Some of the cricket that's been played has been phenomenal. Some of the people I've been chatting to who
wouldn't have been able to tell me the faintest thing about cricket before that day, have become experts overnight. And it's a really cool thing for us to be able to be a part of, because, you know, while it's a well-supported sport, there's definitely a certain demographic that supports it. And the really cool thing about the last 12 months is it really has engaged a completely new audience, women and children and people who hadn't thought about cricket as an exciting sport before. So it's a huge positive for us as players. It's a huge positive for the game, and long may it continue.
And where were you when, first of all, the World Cup final happened, and then when Ben Stokes did what he did in the third test at Headingley?
So the World Cup final, we were actually playing a four-day game against Glamorgan at Cardiff. It had been a long old day. It was a pretty flat wicket, and we came off after fielding most of the day, and we saw it heating up towards the end. We literally didn't watch any of the boring part of the game, because the funny thing about that game was it was a great finish, and it's one of the greatest games ever to be played, but fundamentally the first 90 odd overs were quite dull. I think as a cricket fan the pitch wasn't amazing necessarily.
It wasn't a massively high scoring game,
it wasn't a hugely high scoring, no one got a big score. You know, no one took a bag full of wickets. So we skipped all that. We came off, and it was absolute madness. I mean, and obviously, with Owen being a good friend of ours, and a member of our team as well, for Morks to do that, it's just such a special thing to have someone who you know and respect, and somebody who's helped us a lot, to see him achieve that. It's an incredible feeling.
And what about the 130-something when Ben Stokes won the test from seemingly
that was funny. So my housemate is a guy called a young fast bowler called Tom Helm. And we, I suppose, like everyone else in the country, yeah, we didn't think it was possible going into that day, especially going into when they were nine down. We played a fair bit against Leachie, so we know he's no mug with the bat, but you don't have to be a mug with the bat to get out to Cummins or Hazelwood or Stark or Lyon or these boys, especially as a left-hander on day five. Nathan Lyon bowling around the wicket, it's you had three of the best seamers and the best spinner bowling at a number 11 in Test cricket. So I think what Stokes did was phenomenal. One of the best innings you will ever see, but the part that a few of those boys played towards the end was extraordinary. Joe Denley's innings was amazing the night before. Rooty batted extraordinarily well. We were tossing up whether to go to the shops with about 60 to win. Something inside us, probably like a lot of people, I think when you reflect back on these days, people say, well, yeah, he's the sort of player that instills that in supporters, I think. So, you know, you're never leaving the game while he's still there, which is the biggest accolade I think you can have as a player. So even though we all thought it was done, 2% of us thought, well, if Stokes is there, you never know, we'll see how we go. And as it got to single figures, it was just like, we spoke about momentum earlier. I mean, the momentum shifted when there was 20 to win and these reverse sweeping blokes into the crowd. I think it became inevitable there for a bit. And with Lyon's drop, that's, I think, a prime example of a momentum shift where he's done that 1,000 times and 999 times he's taken the bails off there. But the sport is funny, and cricket in particular, when it's not going your way for an hour or an hour and a half, you know, it's really tough to find it.
Speaking about momentum still then, cricket has undergone somewhat of a transformation, as you said. You're sort of seen as now rock stars and things like that. And you mentioned this brand new tournament, the 100 coming in next year. Do you think that will help accelerate the momentum and actually, again, push cricket in a similar way to we saw after 2005, like to the forefront of people's imagination in this country?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting one. I mean, as players, it's been a huge talking point for the last year, year and a half, this competition, both as an opportunity as a player and also just as cricket fans. I think they're talking about engaging a new audience and they're talking about making cricket accessible for everyone. I'm not entirely sure of how that's going to work. I think we're going to have to wait and see. I think fundamentally, though, having the best players playing at the highest standards and the biggest grounds has to be a huge positive. There has been some speculation around the competition, and I suppose some of it rightly so, but fundamentally, people like watching really good cricketers play against other really good cricketers. So by condensing the number of players and condensing the number of games, the quality immediately goes up. So, yeah, they might be marketing the competition in a certain way, but I fundamentally think the most exciting thing about that is you're going to be seeing the best against the best on the best grounds. So from my point of view, it's definitely going to be a success. You know, whether their definition of success is the same as mine, I'm not entirely sure, but I do think having it on free-to-air TV is going to make a huge difference, because you're immediately there accessing people who might not want to pay for, you know, the privilege to watch cricket. And like you said, in 2005, I think that was the reason why it was a talking point for so long, because it was so accessible to people who, if there's nothing on to watch, it's a sort of sport. And in that period of the summer, you've been watching games at different times of the day when you get home from work. It's going to be sort of the dull watching in the background, which I think is a positive, because if it can capture someone's attention that hadn't previously been exposed to it, then that's a great thing.
You mentioned there about sort of changing things and scaling down the number of players and stuff. And from my point of view, my argument is that they could have done that with a brand new sort of franchise T20 league like the BBL. Is that something that, as players, you've discussed, or is the different format something completely new, something that sort of intrigues and excites you?
I think that's what they've gone for. I don't think anyone... I find it quite funny, people who think they're experts on the new competition, because no one fundamentally has a clue. I don't even think the organisers do. The players that got picked up don't really have a clue, and neither do any of the other cricketers around the country. So I think it is that, it's that shock factor. I think they wanted to get people talking about it. Do I think the cricket's going to change fundamentally? It's 20 less balls and innings. I mean, yeah, there's going to be some nuances or some intricacies of the skill work that will change purely based on you having less time. But I mean, it's not going to be as dramatic a change as the T10 events where guys are going to be teeing off. I still think sides couldn't get bowled out. I still think, you know, scores might not be as high as people think, purely because you can get bowled out in 100 balls, just like you couldn't start a T20. I suppose the main difference between the start of this competition and the start of the T20 competition was people don't see this as a gimmick. People see this as something that's going to be hugely important to the development of the game. And so the performance aspect of it is going to be hugely high. As I said, I don't think the change in rules massively. There might be some tactical differences with the 10 ball overs and these sorts of things. But as I said, we'll have to wait and see. But I think it'll be more similar to 2020 cricket than people think.
And finally, going back to sort of the theme of momentum to finish off this interview, we are still a few months away from the season starting yet, but 2020 will be upon us before too long. How excited are you to sort of try and change the momentum Middlesex have been on and take them to white ball finals and make your team a Division 1 county again?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people look back on last year as a disappointment, and as players, we certainly didn't reach the heights that we would have liked to, but there were two white ball quarterfinals that the club hadn't made. A 50-over final in something like 10 years, and a 2020 quarter final in about 5 or 6 years. So there were some huge strides that were taken last year in our group. We had a new coaching staff, which was always going to take a little bit of time to bed in and for people to understand the ethos and the message that was coming down. We've had some further change with a change in captain and with Darvin Milan leaving and Peter Hanscom coming in. So, you know, we're not naive to think that our fortunes will change overnight, but I certainly think the processes we have in place, while not paying huge dividends last year in four-day cricket, we could definitely see the change in mindset as cricketers in the white ball stuff. And, I mean, we're still a bloody good sort of red ball side, and we all know that. It's just funny how people can't exactly put their finger on why we haven't performed to the best of our abilities, but the belief in the group is still strong. The change in leadership, I think, is going to be a positive one for us. The new coaches have had a full winter to try and get the boys playing in the certain way they want, which we saw some of the fruits of last year. So I'm assuming every county cricketer would say the same, but I think there's a huge cause for optimism in our camp at the moment. I think, you know, we've got a fresh, young, exciting squad. We've got guys who have learned a huge amount about themselves over the last 12 months, and we really are, even from an objective point of view, an outsider's point of view, we probably are primed to have a big year. We've got quite a few points to prove to quite a lot of people, and I think for the group of guys that I know that we have, that's as big a motivation as we need.
And finally, from your perspective, how excited and how are you feeling ahead of 2020, not just in terms of your cricket as well, but also going forward and continuing to inspire the future with Team Mintridge?
Yeah, 100%. I think it's always an exciting time of the year, the end of the year. It's that fresh start. We set our goals at the start of the year, and after the day like today, to see the way these different athletes approach their goal setting has been really cool for me and something that I've definitely taken away. And from a cricket point of view, I'm really excited to bounce back from a little bit of a setback. And today and Mintridge is actually quite a great way of looking about that, because the story of every athlete in there was bouncing back from setbacks, and people do it in different ways and people do it in different lengths of time, but I'm really, really excited to try and bounce back and hit my best. We were talking about the feeling of satisfaction you have from hitting those highs after those lows, and I'm really excited for that. And from a Mintridge point of view, I think looking at the way that we're growing as a charity and looking at the diversity of the people and the ages and the religions and everything about what we're doing, I think we're going to be in a great position to touch a lot of people, a great position for our message to be delivered to all parts of the country. And I think it's a really, really cool thing, and I can only see it going up and up from here.
Well, we wish you the very best of luck with everything for the next year, and we'll be following your progress closely. Thank you for coming on and being such a great guest.
Right, no worries. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
A huge thank you to Stevie for being our latest feature interview guest on the podcast. And Will and myself wish him and Middlesex the very best of luck for the upcoming season. There's also another special thank you to the Mintridge Foundation for helping to set up the interview and for continuing to give us access to their amazing ambassadors. Speaking of Mintridge, this episode airs a day after I and our previous episode guest Georgie Roberts ran the Vitality Big Half in London in aid of the charity. You'll all be delighted to know that we survived. I managed a time of 2 hours and 8 minutes, if anyone is interested, but the two of us and the three other Mintridge members who took part have so far collectively raised £1,592. The legs feel like jelly, but it was so very worth it. This Saturday, that is March the 7th, it's a big day for us on the podcast as we will be hosting our first live show at Superpod 2020 in Southampton in aid of Sport Relief. Unfortunately, our guest, Hannah Diamond, has had to pull out of the show due to her sailing commitments, but we do have the awesome Team GB sailor Ailey McIntyre joining us instead for our show. Undoubtedly, there will be plenty to talk about with her ahead of her Olympic debut this summer. All the information about the event and how to get tickets is on the Superpod website. A link to that is in the show notes of this episode. And everything from that event will be streamed live online as well. That is it from me and also from Will on this latest episode of Sportspiel. We would love to see some of you in Southampton next weekend. I'm reliably informed there is a Superpod cocktail on offer at the bar, so it should be a great event. For now, it's goodbye, and we will see you very soon.